Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Welcome one and all to another day here at The Damage Report. I am John Iadarola. That's the same thing you're stuck with every day. But we did decide to mix it up on the other side and bring back to the show, after far too long an absence, Brian Unger returns. Brian,
how's it going? I'm back. I am back, John. You know I love doing this with you. It's, you know, all too infrequent. But I have to represent Georgia now, which is difficult. So here I am repping Georgia.
Are you in Georgia right now?
Mm-hmm. I live here.
I think you told me that you were moving, I completely forgot.
No.
Georgia. No. Okay. Is this a part of the blueening of Georgia? Are you a constituent of Marjorie Taylor Greene? How Georgia have you gone?
You've asked me so many questions. First of all, it's beige, as you can see, and that's something I have to fix. And I saw Marjorie Taylor Greene in a bar in Alpharetta, which is
her
district. And I had such a visceral tsunami going on in my head, gut and heart, and wanted to, you know, talk to her and throw a drink at her at the same time. It just was,
Hopefully you did not do the second.
I didn't do anything. I just sat and talked to the bartender about it and he kind of laughed. But yeah, she's the district over. I'm in Cherokee County. It's pretty red.
Well, you know, if you need an opening, if you want to talk to her, I don't know if you still do. I remember at one point you were pretty big into CrossFit, right? Well, she's, you know, a CrossFit fanatic.
Going to her box and working out and then maybe like having a meltdown there. But then I was like, no, I don't need CrossFit's hard enough. I don't need Marjorie Taylor Greene in my CrossFit class.
Okay.
She's worse than a burpee. She's way worse than a burpee.
She's like the human version of burpees, I think, actually. Yes. I don't want anything to do with either of them. But I think maybe since the last time you were on, Marjorie Greene did once live tweet a review of the Damage Report. So it is possible she's watching.
She did.
So I apologize if your cover has been blown. But anyway.
Well, she's taking her knocks anyway at the moment. So, you know, we can just leave her alone, I guess. I will bump into her then and, you know, Alpharetta and the McDonald's drive-thru. No, she doesn't eat McDonald's, so I don't know.
I cannot speak to that. I don't know. She's a big supporter of Donald Trump. I feel like it would be loyal to eat McDonald's. But anyway.
It's a case as to bookkeeping, which is a very minor thing in terms of the law, in terms of all the violent crime that's going on outside as we speak, right outside as we speak. But this is a case where you pay a lawyer. He's a lawyer. And they call it a legal expense. That's the exact term they used.
Yeah, you pay a lawyer, so it's a legal expense. You know, so if you pay your lawyer to go like knock off your ex-wife or something, it's a legal expense. He's a lawyer, thus every expense is legal. Look, there's a lot of misinformation being spread by Donald Trump in these impromptu little press conferences that he holds outside of the hush money trial. Basically, everything that he said there was either inaccurate or opportunistic or elitist or a melange of all three. The idea that the crimes that rich people commit are not worthy of discussion so long as a single violent crime is going on is both nonsensical and utterly elitist. So just bear that in mind coming from this right-wing populist figure in Donald Trump. But I know that you likely, like me, are probably overwhelmed by all of the developments in the hush money case. So much happens on a daily basis. So much is happening right now as we're recording this that we thought it was worth stopping for just a moment in the early days of this thing and making sure that people know what is being alleged. Because you're going to hear from all these witnesses. The prosecution is going to be crafting their narrative. The defense is going to be, I'm tempted to say defending Trump. I'm going to say more like playing to Trump, really. But how to interpret all that will depend on what is actually being alleged. So we're going to run through basically what came out of yesterday so that we have a foundational understanding of what this case is really about. And this new figure in the case, he'd been there, but he hadn't really been making much of a, he wasn't really present during the jury selection process. That's Matthew Colangelo. So he is terming this a conspiracy effectively between former President Donald Trump, his fixer, Michael Cohen, and David Pecker of the National Enquirer. And he walked the jury yesterday through basically the argument that this was a corrupt scheme to influence the results, the outcome of the 2016 election. And so he says that, well, the basic idea, the narrative is that it began way back in summer of 2015. This is soon after Donald Trump announced that he'd be running for president. So there was a meeting between the three participants to what's being called the conspiracy in Trump's Midtown Manhattan headquarters. And they hatched what the prosecutor is calling the Trump Tower conspiracy, which you're going to hear a lot about. The idea was to watch out for any damaging stories about Mr. Trump and then hide them from voters. And they, for some reason, these three men thought, you know what, there might be a few damaging stories. And it turned out that they were right. There were a lot of them. Some of them proved not to be true. The story of Donald Trump fathering a child out of wedlock turned out not to be true. The stories of him fathering children within the confines of marriage and then utterly ignoring them for the rest of their life, those did turn out to be true, but not the first one about the fake child. Anyway, once Donald Trump was elected and had to repay Michael Cohen for helping to kill some of these stories through hush money payments, there were also concerns about his unwillingness or untimeliness in repaying the National Enquirer as well. He and his company falsified the records to cover it up. It wasn't enough to kill the story. They also had to cover up their efforts to kill the story. And so the prosecution says that Trump agreed to cook the books to cover the $130,000 that were paid to Stormy Daniels. And when Mr. Trump reimbursed Mr. Cohen, they falsified internal records disguising the repayments as routine legal expenses being done through his organization, which has separately already been found guilty of fraud in a number of cases. Now, the defense pitches all of this as simple persecution of a guy running for president. And you're going to hear a lot that all of this is normal. Every part of this is just what running for president is like. You know, you meet up with the National Enquirer and they pay tons of money to buy stories and then not run them. And you pay off all the women you're alleged to have affairs with, just normal sort of stuff that every presidential candidate has. But obviously, a lot of it is going to come down to who crafts the better, more convincing story for the jury. Can they present this as a corrupt scheme? Because the falsification of the records only rises to felony level if it is to cover up another crime, a crime that he's not being charged for, but that is now being detailed day to day in this trial. Or is this election interference persecuting a guy who was just running for president? Brian, this is the first that we are talking about this. And I am curious, as you've been following this, what do you think about the stories that are being told by the two sides?
Well, you know, as someone who worked the OJ trial, and I'm not kidding, when I was at CBS News as a reporter, I'm basically being reacquainted with that phrase, mountain of evidence. Mm-hmm. Mountain of evidence. I haven't heard that since the OJ trial. That is when, you know, the prosecution had this enormous amount of evidence that seemed like it would just bury OJ. There were bloody socks in his laundry room. There was a knife outside the pool, Cato Kalin's cottage. There was blood everywhere in the Bronco. This guy was basically short of dripping blood and holding the knife. They had him, but yet somehow he got off. There was a juror who basically, and several jurors who were able to sort of buy into the defense, claiming that, you know, there was bias built in. And I hear this now in this, they're basically saying that Michael Cohen, their chief lead witness, is basically tainted, is biased, is prejudiced, is untrustworthy. So I even though it's like legally, it seems like a slam dunk, I'm worried that he's just going to basically walk. And also, I have to say, he's got to get better microphones for these press conferences. His audio sucks. And when you're shouting in a cavernous lobby at the, courthouse, nobody cares and nobody's listening. My mom can't hear that. If my mom can't hear it, America can't hear it. So I would say let's move the mic closer or just stop doing these things.
Yeah. I mean, look, nobody even remembers this, but he had alleged that these sorts of impromptu press conferences were going to basically be how he campaigns. He said that earlier in the campaign, he's going to make it in this big spectacle or whatever. It's not really that. It's basically like him live performing with low energy a Truth Social post. So not a great strategy necessarily. I had not known, by the way, that you had worked the OJ Simpson case. I have a vague memory of it. It was going on while I was in school. I don't remember a lot of the day-to-day stuff, but I am curious. I know, full disclosure, I'm not a lawyer, you're not a lawyer, but you have played a lawyer on TV. Do you think, because a lot of people are concerned that like one MAGA person is gonna get on the jury and basically would never like the a guy could like Trump could murder that guy's family in front of him and he would never convict him. But I am curious, in these sorts of cases where they're in a room and they're discussing, do you think that maybe a person might right now think I would never convict him under any circumstances? But once you're having those conversations, is there a social pressure? Is there like a jury pressure to be reasonable? Maybe, what do you think?
I do. I think like, you know, the OJ, if you're going to make comparisons to it, the OJ trial, probably when it started, I think they would have convicted him. But as the narrative gets elevated to something very far away from the facts that are being like debated, and it starts to turn into a different narrative, which is someone on that jury could start buying into an idea that basically this is election interference and that Michael Cohen is very untrustworthy. He's already been to jail once. Like if the prosecution does their job, which they're, you know, probably I wouldn't underestimate them, and they can get people to look away from the facts, then he is fine. He'll walk away. Just as this jury, just as the jury did for OJ. They started buying into the, and then the revenge of for the Rodney King and the outcomes there that they were basically like rebelling against and wanted to sort of thumb their nose at the justice system. The further you get away from the facts, the more you sort of start buying into their narrative, the more danger will be for this prosecution.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not a legal expert, and I do play, you know, I am an expert in bird law, and I know these things, but I was at the OJ trial, and I was there, and I listened to the testimony every day, and I was in Los Angeles for the entire thing, and I was convinced he would be guilty because I bought into just nothing but the facts. But then we all learned a different story or a lesson from this, is that the narrative can be something completely different for the jurors.
100%. Yeah. And I think that we're all well aware after the last decade or so that facts have very little to do with anything that happens anymore. So I think that there is a mountain of evidence. I think it's compelling. That does not mean that he's necessarily going to jail. So everyone out there, prepare for that.
I am deeply worried that tomorrow, a totally corrupt judge and a totally corrupt district attorney are going to try to put a former president of the United States, candidate of his party, and front runner in the polls in jail. Now, I think this is so horrendous that there has to be some way to reach out to the Supreme Court. I mean, this is literally like some of the civil rights workers in Mississippi in the 1960s.
Get the entire hell out of here. Get every bit out of here with that comparison.
I can't.
Nobody knew where that was going to end, that quote.
And a guy, a guy who literally wanted nothing more than to put Bill Clinton in jail. Every single moment of his life was committed to putting him in jail for stuff that we all know, for stuff that was just, it's so rich. Hearing it come from him.
I know. But that's what the party is right now. They are competing with each other. They're like, they're on ChatGPT, like, give me the most ridiculous, simpish thing I can say about Trump. And Newt Gingrich did pretty well there. saying he's the same as civil rights activists who are locked up when it's Donald Trump, a guy who has been an enthusiastic and legally adjudicated racist for over a half century. That's an amazing bit of propaganda. Kudos to you, Newt Gingrich. Trump, by the way, is sort of falling on. Like he's out there trying to raise money on the idea that, like Newt Gingrich says, he could be locked up any moment. He put out this fundraising email that says, "My farewell message. I hope this isn't goodbye. Tomorrow's my gag order hearing. If things don't go our way, I could be thrown in jail." First of all, no, we cannot. The prosecutors are not asking for him to be thrown away for his many willful violations of the gag order that he's already done. We will be talking a little bit later on about the gag order, though, but that is ridiculous and over the top. Although perhaps not as over the top as Jesse Waters. Take a look at this.
I call it pure evil. So they've taken away his freedom of speech, and now they've taken away his freedom of movement. So he has to sit there all week for 6 weeks. And if he says anything, they'll throw him in jail. If he leaves, they throw him in jail. That's crazy. Mm-hmm. I mean, they had more allowances for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. I think they bought $1 million soccer field for the people in Gitmo. I don't know if Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was able to visit his son for his high school graduation, but it's similar. They're freezing him to death. They're putting him in a meat locker. He says it's like 45 degrees in there. And they're putting his life in danger. And they're telling the entire world, all the wackos, this is where the former president's going to be at this date, at this time, surrounded by high-rise buildings.
The Five is just North Korean state media. That's all it is at this point. Like, they're freezing him to death. It's 45 there. Literally no one else has been complaining about the cold, only Donald Trump. His freedom of speech is gone. He's violating the gag order literally every day. It has had no effect on him. His freedom of movement. The dude could barely move before the trial began. And I will remind everyone, he has to be there. He's a defendant in a criminal trial. Again, all of these arguments are, you know, they're fawning. They're basically verbally bowing at Donald Trump's feet, but also fundamentally elitist. The idea that Donald Trump, who is facing felony charges, 36 of them nearly, oh, he should just be able to go do whatever he wants. You poors, if you ever run afoul of the law, they're going to lock your ass up. You're going to have to be there. But not the rich people. They're obviously better than us. That is what Jesse Waters is saying. Brian, I have an even more ridiculous bit of video, but first I want your thoughts about this.
I know. I mean, I find it just so much just hyperbole and show business that all of this sort of violation of his free speech and, you know, he's so oppressed and he is this victim. He's basically Jesus Christ who's being marched to the mount and being, you know, I just find it so laughable. You know, his lawyers could give a press conference every single day and every morning if they wanted to. And they could talk about the case and they can talk about details of the case. You just have to do it without trying to attack the jurors and people who are like working in the court. Which yep. I think is another thing that like no one really ultimately cares about the clerk in the court. Like you're really super serving a very small demographic of like conspiracy theorists who believe like the clerk is corrupt. I mean, what about the stenographer? Is the stenographer corrupt too? Mm-hmm. Like I just do it without attacking individuals and ad hominem attacks on like people who are officers of the court. You can talk about the case. You just can't do that. So all of this is kind of like laughable.
I mean, I don't know about the clerk, but I do know that he was complaining that the sketch artist was out to get him with the images that they were putting out. So
they usually are, because none of those is flattering images of anybody. So
that's true.
Yeah. I wonder if they're, where do you go to become a sketch artist, by the way?
I don't know. I'm not talented in that area. But in any event, I want to close out with just one more little video of Jesse Waters. In this case, I think he's almost low-key making fun of Donald Trump, but in the service of supporting Donald Trump. Take a look at this.
The guy needs exercise. He's usually golfing. And so you're going to put a man who's almost 80 sitting in a room like this on his butt for all that time. It's not healthy. You know how big of a health nut I am. He needs sunlight and he needs activity. He needs to be walking around. He needs action. It's really cruel and unusual punishment to make a man do that. And anytime he moves, they threaten to throw him in prison.
Okay, I love him just continually saying that Trump needs exercise. You know, tough love from Jesse Waters. But also, I love that they're talking about him like he's an Australian Shepherd puppy. Like, how dare you just keep him in the apartment all day long? He needs to run free in the sun. He's gonna be okay. It's a trial. The dude supposedly was president and sat in an office, the Oval Office. He was supposedly a businessman and sat in an office in Trump Tower. He sat on his butt quite a bit through his life. I think he can make it through this. The idea that like it's unfair to make someone sit in court, but we're only going to care about that for Donald Trump. Jesse Waters is not going to talk about like, you know, people who are up on drug charges being forced to sit there and not get exercise. Again, so elitist to its very core.
It was Todd Blanche, the attorney for Donald Trump, that met the scorn of Judge Mershon, who I just want to read you the very specific quote after those proceedings. Quote, "You're losing all credibility. You're losing all credibility with the court. I have to tell you," the words of Judge Mershon to Donald Trump's attorney.
And that is pretty strong when a judge is saying, now granted, the jury was not there, bear that in mind. The jury isn't hearing this, but repeatedly stating that Trump's lawyer is losing credibility. That is strong. He went on to say, "You've presented nothing." That's what the judge said. Now, the lawyer did talk a lot. His arguments just had very little to do with the law, and we want to give you some more details.
Todd Blanche was struggling to respond to two specific points in his defense of Donald Trump's social media posts. Number one, for those that were in the words of Donald Trump, he was saying that his client was simply responding to attacks against him from the likes of Stormy Daniels and Michael Cohen. But when Judge Mershon asked, "Name me specifically which posts those were," Todd Blanche was unable to give specifics. In the second one were multiple reposts on his Truth Social account, and Todd Blanche was not able to specifically answer whether Donald Trump was in fact endorsing those, other than saying that they were not actual statements by Donald Trump. And now, for history's sake, number one, the prosecution said, look, Donald Trump has boasted in the past about how many people read his posts on social media, including on Truth Social. And I actually went back to the archives in 2015, Donald Trump was asked specifically whether his retweets equaled endorsements. And he said, quote, "Well, I do retweets. And I mean, to a certain extent, I do. Yeah, I think that's right. Do you want me to say no? You know, I retweet for a reason."
And I think that we can fully understand what the reasons are in this particular case. Brian, I want to go to you. We understand psychologically why he has to do this and why, because of how small he is, this has to become such a big part of this trial. But it really just does feel like, how does he not have anyone around him that can stop him from continually undercutting himself at every opportunity? What do you think?
I think those people are around him. And when they open their mouths to try to lasso him or control him, they wind up getting fired. I think the gravy train is probably a nice place to be in the Trump world because of all the money that's there. So if you're a lawyer, you're making a lot of bank. You're not going to stay in your job if you criticize him. I think there is an ash heap of people who, during his presidency, who tried to control him and stop him and tried to edit him live, and he fired them and then spoke badly of them. He's uncontrollable, Yeah, I think that you're kind of screwed if you're trying to keep him quiet. I mean, that's the irony of a gag order, like trying to gag him, trying to stop him. He'll stop at nothing other than being in jail without a computer and a phone.
Yeah. You know? Being stuck off like in the Arctic or something without a cell phone.
It's kind of like a heroin addict or someone who is an alcoholic. Like, they're never going to really. If you keep giving them the booze or the heroin, they're never going to stop. But like friends of mine who've been addicts, they've always said, like, you know, the only thing that got me to quit was going to jail.
Yeah.
I mean, well, I don't know. I mean,
maybe that'll help him.
He's addicted to his narcissism. So he has to keep that flame burning hot and his ego running hot.
I'm so addicted that when he was banned from Twitter for trying to overthrow the government, he created his own social media site. So he would always be able to post whatever he wants. And I often wonder, for people like him and people like Elon Musk, who can't go 7 seconds without posting on social media, like, imagine what they could accomplish perhaps if they didn't do that. Like Trump could, I don't know, like spend time with his family. He has a bunch of kids. I know that he often forgets that, but like he could theoretically spend some time with them. He could campaign. He could come up with a policy or something. Like there are things they could do. But instead, he continually, again, we've been through multiple rounds of the gag order. And despite that, he violates it every single day. On True Social, in his press conferences, he has done that in the last 24 hours. He has done that multiple times, not just since the gag order was clarified yet again, but since the prosecution last week said that they want him to be censured, fined, and if he keeps violating it, go to prison for contempt over it. He just keeps doing it over and over and over again. And I would say, and you've covered more trials than me, no one in American history has been granted as much opportunity to do what he is doing as he is right now. And even that isn't enough for Fox News and his defenders, who would argue that this is a violation of his First Amendment rights. Anyone else in America would have already been locked up over these violations, but not Donald Trump. That said, we will find out later on today. I think we're expecting the judge to potentially rule on this. So fingers crossed. Again, they're not going to lock him up based on the violations he's already done. All the prosecution has asked for is $1,000 for each violation, which for a billionaire is nothing. It doesn't matter at all. And a warning that if he continues to violate it, then he could be found in contempt and possibly go to jail. So we will see. The judge has been strong in some aspects of this case so far, but that is a line that I don't think he wants to cross. And Trump is really sort of like forcing him into a corner here. So we'll see what happens. Any final thoughts on the trial before we move on?
No, I agree with you. I think they'll probably fine him for these things. It'll amount to like $7,000 or something like that. But the question is, what happens next?
Yeah, nothing.
Here's the biggest problem, Alex. Most of my Republican colleagues, everybody in Washington, D.C., all of the political consulting class, they're angry at me. They're saying, oh, we need to wait till after Trump wins the election. Oh, we're going to fix all this stuff next Congress. Alex, I'm not so sure that Trump is going to be able to win the election. This is April. I know the polling looks good, but November's a long ways away.
So two things stand out about that. First of all, it's probably not even worth mentioning, but she is doing an interview with Alex Jones, an absolutely deranged conspiracy theorist who owes hundreds of millions of dollars to the people that he's defamed. We're just going to ignore that. And a congresswoman just goes on his show knowing that there will be no consequences. Okay, so we're moving on with her life. The second is that she said that she doesn't know if Donald Trump can win in November. Now, don't get too excited. Pump those brakes. She references that the 2020 election was stolen, which it wasn't, but she clings to that because she can't accept reality. And so she's implying there that this could also be stolen. So they will not be able to, you know, sweep like the Mike Johnsons and all of that out of Congress on the back of a renewed like wave of MAGA people because the deep state is going to steal it. But as conspiratorial as that is nothing on what she says in this clip.
He's fighting as hard as possible. He's putting all he has into trying to win the election. But you also got to remember, he's at the same time he's trying to run for president again, he's having to put everything he has into defending himself against these rigged trials and this unbelievable perversion of our justice system. And the Democrats aren't sorry about it. They aren't going to back off of what they are doing. They literally want him dead. Benny Thompson introduced a bill to take away his Secret Service protection. That's how serious they are. They want President Trump dead. They want to lock him up in jail for the rest of his life so that he dies in jail. And they want to take away his Secret Service protection so that he is murdered somewhere in jail, possibly.
Okay, that's a lot. So Marjorie Greene is right about a few things there. The Democrats have filed a bill to strip his Secret Service protection if he's convicted. And Brian, I definitely want your thoughts about whether he should have Secret Service in the slammer. But just to be clear, I don't want him dead. As a Democrat often accused of having Trump derangement syndrome, I don't want him dead. Or actually, let me modify that. I don't want him killed. That's crazy. That's your side. Think about how thoroughly you must have normalized the idea that your political opponents should face violence, even death, to just baselessly throw it onto the other side. I mean, she's the one talking about how if she had been in charge on January 6th, they would have brought guns and they would have succeeded. I'm not the one spinning fantasies of this, of like the renewed civil war. That's your side, Marjorie Greene. But anyway, I'm just speaking for myself, Brian. If you want him dead, feel free to confess that here. And what do you think about the Secret Service thing?
Well, I think there's something more, there's a bigger idea here, which is thinking of the afterlife, thinking of Trump's afterlife. This is now his own constituency thinking of him as a martyr, someone who's actually gone, and what his legacy will represent. And they already are fantasizing then about him dying in prison. How? I mean, is he eating in the lunchroom and the Bloods or the Crips or one of those gangs in there with a teardrop on the cheek goes like, let's take out Trump. First of all, he would be best friends with everybody in prison. You know that. He's charismatic. People would love him. He's like a celebrity. No one's going to get any points for like shiving, Trump and but I mean, I just think it's more interesting that they're thinking about him and I think that people are so fatigued. I mean, she also talked about in that conversation about, wasn't a conversation, but that recitation about how Republicans are sort of like, they're over it. They may not even vote in November because they're just so sick and tired of how the House handled the Ukraine aid and all of this stuff. I think that there's just this fatigue is really setting in on Trump. Like it's almost as if a celebrity has overexposure and as a PR handler, you'd want them to like dial it down. People get tired. I mean, I grew up in the Midwest and I already can sort of like spot the thinking in Ohio where I grew up, where people just kind of like, they're sort of over him. They're sort of over all of this. So I think Marjorie Taylor Greene's thinking is already there. It's like, he's going to die in prison. Is that's the best outcome that she can kind of like fantasize about or the narrative that she's going to. I find that to be interesting.
Yeah, I think when and if he dies, I think that there definitely will be an attempt, probably a successful attempt, to create a sort of like darker mirror to the Reagan specter that loomed over politics for like several decades. I think there will definitely be people who will be claiming that they're the next Trump or that they're doing what Trump would want or whatever. But more importantly than that, because I think everybody expects that, I think there are probably more people than Trump would like to admit who just want to get to that phase where they get to like have the MAGA thing and like, oh yeah, no, I'm Trumpy or whatever, but we don't have to deal with Trump. I agree. I think it's exhausting. So I could sort of see that. That said, there are not Democrats calling for him to be killed. And if he does ever go to prison, which he almost certainly will not, he's not gonna be in the general lockup or whatever. He's gonna be in a nicer cell than any home I've ever lived in or ever will live in. So
I am looking forward to the new HBO series, Orange is the New Orange.
I think we need to see a pilot for that. That could be good.
I mean, I see a someone should make that prison show. Drama. Orange is the New Orange. Yeah. And I just think it's wonderful. We get to see Trump in prison with no Secret Service. This is great.
Oh my God.
About the Secret Service guy. Why don't we assign him one Secret Service guy when he goes to jail? And the story is about that guy.
Yeah.
And what a like awful job he has about trying to keep Trump alive.
Oh my God.
I'd watch that.
Okay. Well, I'd watch a little bit of that.
Oh, that's really rich coming from a woman like Hillary Clinton, how many of her friends have just like mysteriously died or committed suicide? I mean, honestly, that's rich of her. I want everyone out there to know that my brakes on my car have recently been checked and they work. I'm not suicidal. And Hillary, I don't mean any harm to you. Please don't send your henchmen out to me. We understand what you're about.
Dear God. The never ending need to make themselves out to be victims, that you would spin a conspiracy theory that Hillary Clinton is so desperate to stop Carrie Lake that she's going to have her rubbed out by a hitman or something. That's a convenient way to raise some money, perhaps, for Carrie Lake. To be clear, she is responding there to something that Hillary Clinton said. We're going to play the clip for you and we will decide if it was a reasonable response from Carrie Lake. Watch this.
The former prime minister of Australia, who said he saw Trump with Putin and Trump was like, just gaga over Putin because Putin does what he would like to do kill his opposition, imprison his opposition, drive, you know, journalists and others into exile, rule without any check or balance. That's what Trump really wants.
Yeah, so I don't see exactly how you go to that and you get that she's gonna have Carrie Lake killed. But by the way, this is something Carrie Lake's been saying for a very long time. The same lines, basically. Back in 2022, she said, my brakes are in good shape and I'm not suicidal. Who is trying to kill Carrie Lake? I will never understand this. And first of all, if it is like necessarily suspicious that your friends turn up dead or whatever, well, I don't know. Trump's friend Jeffrey supposedly killed himself in prison. Is Trump suspicious for that reason? And anyway, when it comes to Carrie Lake, like they keep saying this. She's saying it about herself. They've been saying it about Trump for a very long time, that they're gonna have him killed. And I've been saying for a very long time, then why don't they do it? Like if the deep state wanted to kill Trump, they've had years. Do we not think that they could have done it at this point? There's been no even failed attempt to kill Donald Trump. It like is such a stupid thing to say and then have immediately disproved day by day when they don't have him rubbed out. Why? They will not answer the question, why doesn't the deep state have him killed? And they've got nothing. What do you think about this?
I first of all, I'm asking like, who is she trying to appeal to in that with even with the joke that she's making, if she's joking? We're talking about Vince Foster dying during the Clinton administration. I mean, you're playing to just a tiny percentage of the room when you start talking like that. She has like bigger fish to fry, as my mom would say, like in terms of trying to win a Senate race in the state of Arizona, where millennials, like where generations who can't even remember Ronald Reagan barely are gonna be voting. Like I don't understand why she's, people must, a lot, the majority of viewers who see that or hear that wonder, what is she talking about? Like my brake lines and suicide. Mm-hmm. These are like really dated references and she's playing to like the mad right old conspiratorial wing of a party that doesn't even exist anymore. Like I find it just to be bad messaging. God, she's a terrible candidate. She's another person who can't be controlled. And she's like, just you know, if you were her handler, if you were her person who like was running her campaign and you, that's the best message you can come up with to win in Arizona. Yeah. I mean, wow, that's
I think
want
it's
that
two,
job.
That's true. I think it's at least two things. I think one is the sort of messaging that gets you through a Republican primary is not the same thing that gets you to win the general election. She found that out back in 2022, by the way, and seemingly hasn't learned a lesson. And then the other one is there are these, the right is such a weird thing online that there are these people that just like accidentally become famous. Like Carrie Lake and Marjorie Greene are both people that just started saying some crazy stuff and now I guess will be politicians. Like they didn't work their way up through the system. They haven't learned along the way. They're just suddenly like, I guess I don't have to have a regular job anymore. I'm just always running for office. But that doesn't mean that they're actually qualified to do that. And so Marjorie Greene at least happened to be that person in a solidly red district where you can say and do whatever you want and win. But Carrie Lake is not that, Arizona is not a red district in Georgia. And so that's why I think she's had much more trouble actually getting elected. I know everyone's attention is on the Trump hush money case and understandably so, but there are some fairly compelling developments in his other cases. And here we want to focus on the classified documents case and specifically what has now been revealed having to do with one of the chief witnesses that's expected to be a big part of this. One of the big players, the characters in this case, Walt Nauta, obviously the valet to Donald Trump, who was integrally involved in some of the movement and storage of these boxes of documents. He was apparently told that if he ended up being charged with a crime, including lying to the FBI, that Trump would pardon him when he becomes president again. Now he's being told this before being charged with any crime. And when you go to a person and say, if you get charged, don't worry, I've got your back. Even if you lie to the FBI, I don't even think you need to wink at that point. I think the message has been delivered and that is what is now being alleged. It's coming out of a redacted summary of a November 2022 interview that was given to the FBI by a witness that's being described in the documents as person 16. He was apparently told, well, Nada was, that the investigation was not going anywhere. That turned out not to be true, actually. It did go somewhere, although slowly. That it was politically motivated, a case could be made, and much ado about nothing. And he was told that even if he gets charged with lying to the POTUS, or lying to the FBI, POTUS will pardon him in 2024, which I just think is fascinating. I mean, if you are trying to make the case that Donald Trump knew that what he was doing was illegal and that there was an attempt to cover up the crime, and there's a lot of different angles on that, depending on how credible this is and who it is that's said to have said it, this feels fairly damning, Brian. What do you think?
I mean, it's no different from an organized crime family and how they work. I mean, this is just like, and that's, you know, that's also been like a marquee criticism of Trump, is that he's like a mob boss and has always acted accordingly. And this is that too, you know, witnesses taking falls, and I'll make sure your family's set up. Don't worry about anything. And we'll make sure your kids get through college, and I'll personally see it to it that they're fine. I mean, this is the just same old script. Yeah.
Yeah. And we should remember, of course, in not in these cases, but Donald Trump has already provided pardons, exonerations to people who have, you know, gone down for being involved in his little schemes. And I guess they showed the loyalty that was expected of them. And then they've gotten out. This is not some deranged commie speculating about what Donald Trump might do with that presidential pardon power. He's already done it. And for less threatening issues, less personally threatening issues than some of these cases are. And bear in mind, not only would he potentially pardon the guy, he's also been very clear that if we get to the election and Donald Trump gets elected, this case is just gonna go away. Like, not all of them can, but this one certainly can. And it's not looking like it's going to be adjudicated before the election. So that is a very real possibility at this point. I can't wait to see what more evidence they have, assuming the case does ever actually go forward. There's also some other details, and you can read about them in the reporting, about more warnings that were given to Trump that they needed to return these documents, that he sort of just, like, again, gave a wink and a nod to, and then just carried on about his business. In any event, I want to make sure that we get to this final story in the I block. So we only have a few more minutes, but whenever ready, everyone, bear in mind, this is a very serious story, is very dark news. But with that said, let's jump into this. So we have some of the most unfortunate, darkest sort of news to report, and it is coming out of southern Gaza. If it's not already clear from that video, more than 300 bodies, I believe the most recent count is more than 310 bodies, have been uncovered in a mass grave outside of a hospital in southern Gaza. This mass grave is alleged to have been just one of three in this particular area. And we're not gonna show, other than one more image, without showing any of the actual remains, just so you get an idea of the scale, like, people were bagged up and thrown into collective graves. And now the questions of who is to blame for this are flying around. And you'll be shocked that some who are being alleged to have been behind this are saying that they're not. But in any event, I want to give you more details about this, including, as you can already see in that photo, the way that the bodies were disposed of. They were not just wrapped up in those sort of like sheets or coverings, as you can see, but some apparently had their hands and feet tied. It seems like they had been bound, and there are allegations of field executions, that people were bound and then they were killed, they were finished off and then thrown into a grave. That is what is now being alleged. They're still searching, by the way, in the area for apparently up to 400 additional people in that area. Now, here's what the IDF has to say about this, because, of course, you know, a lot of the allegations are that they are the ones that conducted whatever it is that happened and produced this mass grave. Israeli military told CNN that at the end of February, conducted an operation against Hamas in the area of that hospital, and that during the operation, about 200 terrorists who were in the hospital were apprehended. Medicines intended for the hostages were found undelivered and unused, and a great deal of ammunition was confiscated. They say that any claim that those terrorists, they're all being assumed to be terrorists, were killed and then buried there by the IDF is baseless and unfounded. And that the only reason that the IDF was digging up bodies was to test if they were hostages. So, and Now, Palestinians are saying that they saw the corpses being buried by Israeli troops with bulldozers. So sort of a mechanized mass grave sort of digging. But again, these are claims that have not yet been like fully adjudicated. So the entire thing is absolutely devastating. We know how many people, you know, have died. Many of their bodies have been able to be recovered. In this case, now there's been a lot of fears about mass graves for a long time. We have this one that's already been found. Are there others in the area? How many bodies will be found? There's a lot of questions out there. And by the way, some people are saying, you know, like coming out of this, that there had been claims that any bodies that were found after the attack near the hospitals there, that they were returned. But people are saying that their family members have not been returned to them, or that the wrong bodies have been returned. So the entire thing is absolutely devastating in every way imaginable. I know it's a difficult thing, Brian, but I am curious about your thoughts about this. I know we haven't talked about this sometime.
I don't know. I was like, I obviously the catastrophe that is growing and continues to grow there is so heartbreaking. And politically, it just paints this horrible outcome that will leave the region far better, worse than it was, you know, when I was growing up, and the same strife sort of was so ubiquitous in the Middle East. And it makes me, it angers me that there isn't global leadership, that nations can't come together in a kind of, and I'm not trying to be glib here, but like in a sort of FDR Churchillian kind of some way that the world, the nations of this planet can't step in and partition this entire region and straighten out what is and put a hold on the violence and the death, bring people to justice who've committed these atrocities, and set a path for at least hopefully the next generation that there could be peace, because none of the outcomes here is good. And I said this to Cenk, like when last time I was on, 2IT, I just like, does anyone have any kind of like idea of what's going to happen when all of this is over? If it ends, and what will there be more security, or will there be less security for people? Will there be more death or less violence? Like, it's just so catastrophic that my I'll be dead before there's peace. So I'm wondering about the next generation.
Yeah.
Not generation, but several generations beyond. What is the outcome? And it calls for something. It calls for a kind of leadership that we haven't seen since the world nations pulled together to defeat, Nazism or some on the scale, on that kind of scale. That's what we need there to kind of like shut this down and bring order and restore order and deliver justice to people who deserve it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would agree. And I would say not just order in comparison to what we have now, but in comparison to what existed before these months of like utterly barbaric behavior. It's not like there was justice and then all of this happened. But I agree. It is difficult to see that something like this can still happen. You would hope, perhaps, you know, maybe a lot of our faith of how good America can be has taken a lot of hits over the last decade or whatever. But you would hope that maybe internationally we could be better. But something like this can happen, and it feels like, oh, this is something that could happen 20 years ago, 50 years ago, 100 years ago. It's the same. We have no more ability to stop this utterly needless violence. And you have your questions about what effect this will have going forward. Well, it doesn't seem like this is the springboard towards a new level of tolerance and understanding. This seems like a massive generator of further radicalization, potentially on both sides. Lots of concerns about what exactly is going to happen to the land of Gaza coming out of this. And definitely doesn't feel like security is laying on the other side. And it feels like it so obviously will not result in more security that it's hard to imagine that you could go into this with that being your goal. And again, I don't, it's all speculation. I'm not a regional expert or whatever, but we know that Netanyahu was perfectly willing to help sort of stabilize Hamas to keep it as a villain. There have been a lot of reports of the quotes he's made about that and all that. So I don't know. It just seems like everything about this is both so tragic and also so obvious that one wonders how we could accidentally end up in a position this bad. But in any event, it's utterly devastating. The idea that you could be waiting for like the return of your family member. Like a guy talked to CNN about his 21-year-old son killed in January, still doesn't have the body. And now what is he left with? To hope that they find him in a mass grave? It is 2024 and we still put people in this position. And when I say we, I don't just mean in the global sense that humanity should be shared in addressing these sorts of issues, but that America is helping this to happen in funding, in weapons, in not using our influence to stop it. We are, by virtue of the actions of Joe Biden and our government, a part of what is happening there. Maybe not a willful part, but we are being dragged along into this. In any event, it's all the time we have for the first hour of the show. Actually, it's more time than we had in the first hour of the show. But I want to thank everyone who's been listening and or watching. For those of you watching live, there's more to come in the aftermath, so don't go anywhere. We'll be back with more.